Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another smooth glass of Amarula for the mind, that being two crickets in a thorn tree. I'm half of your hosts, Mr. Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm, of course, joined today by
Gabriel Krauser. Hello.
The other half of your hosts, yes. So apologies for missing a episode or two. I think it was one. I think it's only one. It was just one. And the reason we missed one is because Gabriel made the terrible mistake of being promoted, which is always a frightfully dangerous thing to do. Yeah. And as a result, he has a lot more work and is we had some scheduling difficulties, basically. We are now back to entertain and enrich, or at least attempt to do those things. And I believe you are part of, because of the thing you've been promoted to, is you're the head of campaigns now, aren't you? Or something like that.
Something like that,
For the Institute of Race Relations, right. And you had a bit of a clever idea to talk about something, to run a little bit of a campaign. So let's talk, why don't you tell us about why you didn't have time for the greatest podcast in the world? What were you working on?
Well, in a sense, I was working on my, like, people skills, because it turns out that if you're like a journalist, then you do have to speak to people, but they're mainly strangers and you're trying to figure out what the truth is. Whereas if you are like in any kind of management or administrative capacity, you have to talk to people and sort of get everyone to work together. Now that is
difficult.
I don't think it's even that hard. I just think it's like so against my nature, man. Jeez, like, it's gonna be like, guys, just don't worry about it. It's gonna be fine. It's like what you just said is interesting, and it reminds me of when I first started joining. When I first joined the institute, our boss Franz Cronier once said, "No, that's a great. What you just said to me is very interesting, but I don't care because I want column inches. This is a factory, and you must produce." And it's not good enough. No, I don't really care that you've got nice ideas. That's wonderful for you. I mean, for you, you're a person. I care about you. But like for the job, it'd be very nice if those ideas were being produced into a product. So I've got to play that role a little bit, which has been interesting for me. The idea that we're trying to carry, very simple. Racism is not the problem.
Not the problem.
It's not the problem. So it is a problem. Of course, it's a problem every time someone is racist to someone else. Where racism, I don't know, let's define it roughly speaking, as something like doing harm to another person on the basis of the color of their skin, whether it's physical or emotional, or career or whatever it is.
Whatever.
So that's, I mean, that's by definition a problem. Harm is problem. Unjust harm. Make it more precise. That's implied in on the basis of their race, because if you're harming someone on the basis of their race, then that's unjust. So it is a problem, but it's not the problem. So why is it not the problem? There's two ways of going about it. One way is sort of intellectual and pretty clever, and I think that's a lot of what we talk about, really. I think a lot of our conversations kind of talk about race, but find that, you know, racism is sort of the veneer, the sort of polish or lacquer around a hobby horse that is driving damaging daggers into people, but where the hobby horse itself is made of something else.
And so it's, I don't know, corruption, socialism, something else, and then racism is put on top of that to give it a bit of extra zing.
Yeah, and it's not that race nationalism isn't a problem. But okay, anyway, so the point is, one way to go about this is to do a root cause analysis, sit in your armchair and think about things and find that racism is not the root cause analysis problem. Right. The other way to go about this is to ask people, what do you think? And that's what the Institute of Race Relations does these surveys all the time, every few years, and we did one towards the end of last year and we finally got the results. And we ask people, what's the major problem? You can say two, open question. You don't know who we are. Just thousands of random South Africans of all sorts, demographically representative across the country. What do you think the problems are? Unemployment, crime, corruption. You don't even have to go through the list. Everyone knows what the list
is.
Right. Yeah. 3% of people say racism is one of the major problems. 97% do not identify. Racism is one of the major problems. Then you wonder, well, what's going on? So you ask people, have you personally experienced any form of racism in the last 5 years? 20% say yes, that's not great. It's a problem. But 80% say no. 80% say they've experienced no racism in the last 5 years.
Right, that's quite interesting.
Yeah, unthinkable 30 years ago, unthinkable 20 years ago.
Right, and it's also quite interesting when you see sort of what Phil's column enters these days. what was it? I don't know if we saw Eusebius Mokhaiza, who's, I don't know what we could call him, the king of racism, in a sense, South Africa.
One of its...
or the cheerleader, the chief cheerleader of racism.
Chief cheerleader, there we go.
So he was, I think, criticized by another journalist for perhaps being a little bit quick to jump on board the racism accusations against Andre de Rita, which I think are laughably transparent as a factional, you know, as a piece of ANC factional business, right? Mm. That the anti-Ramaphosa factional, the anti-de Rita faction, whatever, wants to get rid of him and start using racism as a way to do it. But Eusebius was very perturbed by this. Because I think it would damage his bottom line if racism wasn't the problem.
Yeah. So what's interesting about that story to me is that Andre de Rita fired Solly, I can't remember his surname, the chief procurement officer of Eskom.
Yeah, yeah. Like, who then accused him of racism, right?
De Rita fired Solly like 2 months ago.
Right.
Then Solly says de Rita's a racist. He's just firing because he's black and he's just sort of digging into black companies that or selling coal at 10 times the price and so on and so forth.
Right.
And the evidence immediately and universally points to this allegation of racism being false. And the mainstream media sort of carries the story. In fact, it shows little patience for Solly's accusation. It was actually put down. Then cut to like a month ago or a couple of weeks ago, I had this thing, which I think we talked about on our last podcast, of doing a series of interviews about BEE, Newsroom Africa, ENCA, right, bunch of radio shows. Yeah. And this was one of the examples that I used in some of the interviews. And some of the interviews I didn't even have to say. I could just say, and we can see even now, after coronavirus, after the new dawn, we still have, if someone gets fired or whatever from a major state-owned enterprise, then they say they were fired because of racism. And I didn't have to say it because everyone else on the panel knew what I was talking about and would complete it. And there was just, you know, this common appreciation that everyone knows what's going on here. This is an example so good that you don't have to name it. So it went through that little valley of like being a thing that is talked about to like, okay, not talked about, it's just part of common sense. And then Peter de Toy, who's the deputy chief editor at News24, he writes an article kind of reviving the story. I'm not sure what the news hook was of last week, but anyway, the story went up saying, you know, there's this fake allegation of racism and isn't this embarrassing? And then Eusebius jumps on that. So it's just an interesting sort of reflection on how the news cycle works, that really the biggest name journalists and whatnot, it's easier to jump in once the consensus has already been established in a way.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, it is one example of many where the phrase root cause analysis is something that was taught to me by a guy who used to work at Eskom, oddly enough. And he said, you know, it's a very funny thing especially when there's an electrical fire, you have to do root cause analysis. Or when the power stations aren't working, you have to do root cause analysis. And if you identify a problem that's not the root cause, then you almost make things worse because you go and solve that, and then everyone steps back and gets a sense of complacency.
Right. And you also have wasted resources and you wasted time, and maybe your adjustment actually causes another problem somewhere else.
Yeah, well, it's definitely not solving the main problem, so the thing's going to get, you know, the crisis is going to strike again. And if it's striking again when everyone thinks it's solved and when it's had a longer time to erode the basic structure, then it's even worse. So anyway, our thought is racism is not the problem, I've got another story which just started last week. Cornwall High, which is a private school in Irene, sort of close to Pretoria, that two of my cousins attended, one of my aunts taught at, very, very excellent school, has just apologized for being racist because a black student said that 7 years ago when she was in grade four, she was told that her hair is messy.
So,
I mean, I was told my hair's a screw up, like, literally on a daily basis when I was, for most of my
life. I got in trouble for that, and I didn't get in trouble for much at school.
Well, yeah. So, either turns out Sicilians were super racist against white people, or...
But hold on a second. Haven't we heard this story before? It's Pretoria like an old South African thing.
Yeah,
yeah. There's like a million versions of it, and sometimes there's like a religious angle because it's a dreadlocks thing. You know, someone says I'm a Rastafarian and you can't tell me to cut my hair, and then sometimes it's I don't know.
But so the thing, it's, I mean, where you can tell that there is where you can tell there's some clear racism is firstly that the headmaster apologizes. Like, he wouldn't apologize if he thought he was dealing with real adults. So 15 parents go and walk around the school in a silent protest. 15 black parents. And then the headmaster says, I'm very sorry. Our school clearly is racist. Now, I don't think that if the headmaster thought he was speaking to adults, that he would say that on the basis of the evidence.
So you're saying he's got the soft bigotry of low expectations.
On the available evidence, I'm happy to be corrected, but on the available evidence, that seems very much to be the case. And there's also racism in terms of what the parents were calling for and some of the students, like more teachers who look like me. And I just think it's a completely sick idea. Right. If I don't have children, but if I had children and one of them came back, I mean, I really want to be the no corporal punishment kind of parent because I think that's fancy. But if one of my children came back and said, I'm irritated because my teacher is a different color skin to me.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. That's
I think I would immediately institute a new corporal punishment kind of attitude to
sleeping in the shed and getting gruel tonight.
Yeah.
Kind of punishment. Yeah.
No, that is just not an acceptable thing to say or think. Yeah. It's disgusting.
It's twisted.
And happily, our surveys show that 95% of South Africans agree. Black and white, they say. We say, hey, do you care what color of skin your kids' teachers are? And 95-96% say, no, we just want them to do a good job. So that's great. But the 5% who think, no, my kids are black, so they must have black teachers, or my kids are white, and they must have white teachers, or my kids are Indian, they must have Indian teachers. That 5% manages to do this thing at schools on a, you know, this school, that school, on a fairly regular basis of...
That's madness.
Anyway, so it gets in the way of the thing. Yeah. Okay. And here's why our campaign matters. And so go, you know, if you're listening to this, go to www.racismisnottheproblem.co.za or just Google racism is not the problem. And yeah, you can see the video, but and the text and the reports and whatnot. But here's why I think it's an interesting project. I think that we have such serious problems that haven't really changed. Like, sometimes we complain between you and I that the news in South Africa can feel a bit stuck, like our challenges aren't really changing. But that's because we're not really addressing our challenges. Like, when you really start solving a problem, then you discover new aspects to that problem, and then there are interesting new stories. Like, if we really started dismantling the patronage network rather than one or two little scapegoats, there would be new issues that would emerge out of that. Like, it would be interesting if you did fire thousands of redundant employees in the civil service and you did jail 1,000 corrupt politicians. And this kind of thing has happened before in other countries. It's the kind of thing that could happen. When you do that, that begins to solve the problem, but it does generate new problems and it creates interesting news stories. And, like, there's further analysis to be done.
Yeah. You know,
we don't have that because we're not addressing – any of the serious problems.
We just keep doing the same thing over and over again.
Because and this is the thing. So most people clearly agree that racism is not the problem until you're in the moment where someone tells a very sad story. And instead of saying, but this story is limited to this case and this interesting sort of set of circumstances, says, this story is representative. Someone told me my hair is wrong, and that shows the whole school is a screw-up. Or the whole country's a screw-up.
Right.
Or as in June 16th, I was told last year in Hector Peterson Square, everything is racist.
On the show, great episode.
When that moment comes, most people just go along with it. And what we're trying to do is say, look, you think you're alone. in thinking racism is not the problem. So when someone comes and says, no, the whole problem, the big problem, the root cause analysis is racism is the problem, then you shut up and you listen to it and you think, that's how we need to go forward.
Right.
It's not the right way to think about it. The right way, the right thing to do then, it's actually at that moment that it's the most important. I mean, this question, have you personally experienced racism in the last 5 years? 80% say no. Every single time that I've heard, that I've been on a debate with someone, a black person who says, I experience racism on a daily basis. And then cites as an example something that Adam Kalitsavelos said on a Greek beach or whatever. You know, that's the time for people to speak up and say that's nonsense, right? Because if that happens, the taste makers will stop using that line as a distraction. Right. As a false claim, as a false misrepresentation. It could be an accurate representation of that person's experience of that morning or yesterday or the day before, but it's not an accurate portrayal of what most South Africans are experiencing. Anyway, there's a philosophical story to tell about common knowledge versus individual esoteric beliefs, but I'm not going to get into that. The point is that I think that our conversation would be there's a nice sort of line. Surgeons don't believe in asepsis, but that doesn't mean they do surgery in sewers. I don't think that we're going to fully I really believe there will always be murderers and rapists and racists. But in order to have a good conversation, it's like surgery. You need to be in a relatively antiseptic environment.
Yes.
And so the conversational environment itself has to be one in which racism is not the problem. I couldn't speak to you on a daily basis if you just thought that I was better or worse because I'm a descendant of this bloodline and you're a descendant
right.
of that.
Right.
It just wouldn't work. And so we need to expand that conversational space where it's like, at least here and now in this conversation, anyone can say racism is not the problem because it's not the problem in this conversation. And furthermore, we have good data that it's not the root cause problem of South Africa's current challenges. It's not the thing that's currently holding us back. And furthermore, most South Africans agree. And furthermore, we asked the question, are most politicians talking up racism to excuse their own failures? Most South Africans agree. Once that becomes common knowledge, once that defines the conversational space, we don't get to relax and take it easy. That's when we can begin the real work of confronting our real problems as neighbors, as fellow citizens, as fellow human beings, and actually get something done about them rather than just sort of live in this universe of more same, more same. Anyway, so I'm very excited about the project, and it's got like many weeks of rollout, and we promise to do such a good job of attracting your attention that we will stand a very good chance of getting it outside of the Two Crickets podcast. But right. that is
should,
kind
you
of
should hopefully hear about it without just listening to this podcast. That's the goal anyway.
There you see it. It has been a wonderful thing to work on for a little bit, and it has been very day and night and making videos and dealing with sort of advertising companies and billboards and all kinds
so
of very.
You've made me think of something which is quite interesting, and if I may be permitted to digress for a moment,
you must.
Some of what is going on here surely is to do with the fact that, and you can, it's a story as old as time. It's not even a particularly unique thought. But this ability to denounce figures of authority being given to kids is definitely a bad idea, because that's one of the recurring aspects of this kind of woke identity politics stuff, is that because there's no distinction made in qualities of accusations. A teenager who's had a big falling out with school authorities over something is taken just as seriously as, I don't know, a professor at the most esteemed institution in the world making that accusation. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is, as a man who's spiritually 40 years old, 60 years old, it always makes me a bit worried when the youth get empowered too much.
Well, I think you and I were both like this, right? I think we were both, as high school kids, pretty precocious. And for that very reason, pretty keen on, like, high schoolers not having the right to vote.
Yeah.
Like, that struck me amongst my peers as a very superficial but useful litmus test of maturity. If you're a 15-year-old and you're like, we should have the right to vote, my response as a 15-year-old was like, dude, you are exactly the instilled embodiment of why 15-year-olds should not vote. This is crazy.
It's a little bit like that theory of power, which the only people who should be allowed to wield power are those who don't want it. It's kind of similar.
Yeah, it's got this funny sense of irony. But it's got another connection to the race thing, which I suppose is like a background theme for me, which is that I think it's very important to have a kind of tolerance to racists. I mean, or racialists, people who try and get kudos out of their race. Because I think it's a sort of understandable mistake. I can see how you can sustain that mistake for a while. I think it becomes intolerable once it starts harming other people and so on and so forth. But when kids are at school and they, you know, learn some fact of history which makes their race seem amazing, and then they feel a course of warm blood pumping through their veins, right, their hairs stand on end,
if there's anything we can say about teenagers, is that they desperately want to belong to something.
Yeah, and so they want to belong to their race. Okay, that's fine. And the reason I like that is because I just like this philosophical distinction of like phase sortals, sort of kind of philosophical term for those objects or kinds of things, those things, shall we just say, that if you understand what this thing is, you understand that it stops even though it doesn't break. It stops existing even though it doesn't break. So a clock stops being a clock when it breaks, right? So a clock is like it's not a phase sortal. It's a permanent sortal. I can't remember what the other term is. But a phase sortal, the paradigm, the key example is teenager, right? You stop being a child, you become a teenager. You stop being a teenager, you become an adult. Not because something's broken. I mean, you can think of ways in which something is broken, but it's really the natural and healthy course of things.
Definitely, right.
Where you understand this to be a phase. And I think racism, being a racist or a racialist, like taking pride in your own race, it is like a phase. And the tragedy is that some people get stuck in this adolescent state for all their lives.
Yeah.
And part of the mission of saying racism is not the problem is to sort of identify and expand that adult space, which, by the way, young children can be very good at occupying. But to expand this common ground where racism really isn't the problem, so that people at the start of it can just try it out. Just try it on like a new pair of shoes and see how it feels. See if it keeps your feet dry. Walk around a bit. Take them off. Go back into your old sneakers or whatever. But maybe, you know, you try it out and you like it. You're like, okay, you're embarrassed in some situation, and then you go along with your race kind of narrative. Then you try it out again. Maybe that actually becomes the stuff you move around in after a while. And then you phase out of like a juvenile experience and you phase into something more interesting and profound. On which note, I would like to talk about the juvenile experience of Shelby Steele.
Yes, much anticipated. You did say last week that we were going to do a reading from Shelby. Sorry, last episode, not last week, that you were going to do a reading from Shelby Steele to illustrate perhaps to our readers why you think he's such a I don't know, what's the phrase the kids use these days? Big brain.
He's big brain. He is. So just to refresh, okay, so this is a reading. I'm going to be reading a page in a bit. It would be 5 minutes, so just sit back.
Get that glass of Amarula or your non-alcoholic substitute.
Yeah. And enjoy. The context, this is the 60s, I think, in America, and it's definitely like a pretty racist America. And Shelby Steele is, he's looking back on that time. He writes this in 1989, when he's an adult and has very much undergone some maturation in his thinking. And part of the reason that I wanted to flag this was because we talked about data. I mean, right now, the racism is not a problem thing is largely being grounded in data, these sort of surveys, GDP analysis and so on. And I think one of the things that the woke guys talked about is lived experience. And I think people get put off by that. Well, people who are suspicious of wokeness, they think that there's no room for talk of lived experience. Well, if that's what you think, then listen to this. When I was 14, the mother of a white teammate on the YMCA swimming team would, in a nice but insistent way, correct my grammar when I lapsed into the black English I'd grown up speaking in the neighborhood. She would require that my verbs and pronouns agree, that I put the G on my ings, that I would say that instead of dat. She absolutely abhorred double negatives, and her face would screw up in pain at the sound of one. But her corrections also tapped my racial vulnerability. I felt racial shame at this white woman's fastidious concern with my language. It was not as though she was saying that the black part of me was not good enough, would not do. Sorry, it was as though she was saying the black part of me was not good enough, would not do. And this is where my denial went to work. I never admitted to the racial shame I felt. Instead, I decided that she was being racist and humiliating me out of some perverse need to feel better about herself at my expense. And this is the real problem with denial. To deny one reality, my feelings of racial shame, we always create another reality to cover over the real one. So there are always two very dangerous elements in any denial: recomposition and distortion. We recompose new feelings to cover over those that threaten us. And these new feelings always distort the threatening situation into something different than what it really is. Rather than feel racial shame, I recompose the situation into a tableau of racial victimization in which this woman openly scorned my race. This recomposition gave me some peace for a time, because it allowed me to externalize my shame, to transform it into anger at her. But of course, my vulnerability was still at work. And one day, when her eyes rolled at some rather glaring lapse, I decided it was time to do something. I told her son I thought she didn't like black people and was taking it out on me. A few days later, she marched into the YMCA rec room, took me away from a ping pong game, and sat me down in a corner. It was the late 50s, when certain women painted their faces as though they were canvases, and onto this woman's face were painted a pair of violently red Valentine's lips, two perfectly arched eyebrows, and a black beauty mark beside her mouth. It was the distraction of this mask, my wonderment at it, that allowed me to keep my equilibrium. She told me about herself, that she had grown up poor, had never finished high school, and would never become more than a secretary. She said she didn't give a good goddamn about my race, but that if I wanted to do more than sweat my life away in a steel mill, I better learn to speak correctly. As she continued to talk, I was shocked to realize that my comment had genuinely hurt her, and that her motive in correcting my English had been no more than simple human kindness. If she had been black, I might have seen this more easily. But she was white, and this fact alone set off a very specific response pattern in which vulnerability to racial shame was the trigger, denial and recomposition the reaction, and a distorted view of the situation the result. This was the sequence by which I converted kindness into harassment and my racial shame into her racism. I believe this sequence is one of the most unrecognized yet potent forces in contemporary black life. Mm. So that's just an extract of the essay, and it is called The Recomposed Self. I think that is
what I think the kids would call a spicy passage.
Dude, if you read, I for legal reasons, I think I'm not really allowed to just read the whole essay in this podcast. But if you read that essay, it's very personal and yet very considered, and so has this resonant quality.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, part of what's interesting is that I do think that he's sort of giving a personal account of how the esteem economy works, of this process, and the recomposed self really is about this process of turning disses against oneself into evidence of one's own grandeur.
Yeah.
And that process, that's
a good way of putting it, yeah.
Itself leading into, well, a negative spiral, a perverse feedback loop, something that is in his way impossible to tell without heart, because it is sore. It's heart sore. It's heart sore to pull the theory of ego protection into the reality of badly abused and misspent lives. And I admire his ability to walk a very delicate tightrope. You know, confessions, especially in Europe, have a sort of a Christian tradition that is not altogether salutary. Fancy writers and philosophers would write their confessions often to humble brag, to sort of say how wonderful they are because they have this ability to, you know, look into their own hearts and see these terrible things.
Yeah, exactly. It's a sort of false modesty kind of thing. There's actually, it reminds me also of interesting ways that fascist regimes work in Asia. And I'm not sure how much the Communist Party of China still does this, but I know that the fascist Japanese government did this. It's the process of re-education and the process of turning you from a dissident into a loyal cadre involved you writing lengthy confessions and essays explaining your malice, why you were so disreputable and evil. And it was used as a very effective form of control. And actually, there's a number of interesting cases in Japanese history where in the 30s, you would have a dissident, usually a sort of a socialist or maybe someone who's a bit of a liberal, writing about how they get arrested, they get imprisoned, they get pushed through some sort of re-education camp. And then they are forced to write public essays confessing to their sins.
Mm.
And what's funny is how often, even after the regime collapses, those people continue to hold those beliefs very aggressively.
It's very strange.
And I think it does that psychological trick that those regimes figured out is definitely at play in some of the ways that we talk about race and racism. Is that,
Exactly. It's like there's this psychological trick where some people seem to have figured out that as hard as it is to say I'm sorry, it's even harder to say I'm sorry that I said I was sorry. That was
yes.
That was a mistake. Like our lizard brains just balk at that level of
Once is hard enough, let's not do it again.
So if you can get someone to say I'm sorry, I'm this or whatever, then they're stuck with playing that game. They can't phase out of it very easily. So I think Shelby Steele kind of walks this line of avoiding a sort of garish, self-aggrandizing tone through his confessions, and the way that he avoids it is really by pointing to the interesting thing about it not being its idiosyncrasy, but precisely being the common features that it shares with so many other experiences, that we might inform ourselves how better to conduct things like teaching kids or relating with one another at work or over dinner, or in families. So he really is offering himself on the altar of example. Like there's something to this. This is a teachable moment, is the old phrase, rather than using some example to really show something fancy about himself. And that humility, I suppose, is something you'll have to take on my advice. It's what I see in all of the essays that I've read so far, film that I've watched. It is a sort of a subtle kind of literary and reading. It's a recommendation to check it out for yourself to see if you find that.
Of course, because of course, people who aren't well disposed towards him would read that same passage and see nothing but seeking the approval of white masters or whatever other foul racist terms they use.
Yeah, it's an ugly thought, but an precisely accurate one. Yeah. But so, you know, in terms of this thing that you mentioned about the ways that kind of show trials and explicit confessions can drive people to commit themselves to a kind of narrative that makes them useful idiots for a political regime. I think that that's also a nice way of thinking about why the racism is not the problem campaign movement. Let's call it what it aspires to be. Why it's such a good idea is that right now, I think one of the most perverse ways of getting kudos is to advertise to the world that you are a confessed racist. Yes. I confess, I'm terrible, and I've subjugated myself to this reform program, and all will come out well. And at high schools, we see this especially. These high schools that hire consulting firms to come and tell them that they're racist.
Right. And it's usually referred to by a term that you do not like, which is virtue signaling. Because in this case, it's vice signaling.
Exactly, and that's exactly part of why I don't like the term, is because people can signal their virtue by signaling their vice, right? Or rather signal their superior social standing by saying, I'm the kind of person that can afford to say that I'm a racist. I'm the kind of institution that can afford to say it.
I can hire someone to officially produce a report that I'm racist and still come through without a scratch.
Because I'm already so far ahead that in showing my weakness, I can also show how it's very good to overcome. And there's something about this which I find truly appealing. I really am attracted to I do think that the basic idea of classical liberalism was best put by, oddly enough, a victim of the Gulag, Solzhenitsyn, who said the line that runs through good and evil doesn't divide nations or peoples or races or genders or anything or classes. It really cuts through every single human heart. So there is something profoundly important about conceding that that one is a fallen angel, mm-hmm. that one is not perfect, that one makes mistakes. And of course, it's often going to be an easier thing to do the more room one has to maneuver. But the active exploitation of that feature, and in particular with regard to race, in order to signal that one is really on the inside channel of the sort of main power project running the country is just perverse, and it seems to me like if people were more ready to say, look, racism is not the problem here, then when someone says I'm a confessed racist, you could have a more healthy response to that. Instead of being like, oh, well done for admitting it, you could be like, holy moly, that's terrible actually. What the hell?
Why are you telling us this? Shouldn't you be doing something about that?
Yeah, and if you're telling us this, like, what you first need to experience is like a bucket of shame. Shame on you for being a racist. Figure yourself out. How can we help you? Rather than like, oh, well done. You've put it on the – you've appointed 4 permanent staff because you're a racist and – and their job is to tell you that you're a racist for now until forevermore, and this is like, you know, very good. This is progress. It is just
it's a bit like a medieval king having clergy around him to tell him how sinful he is every day.
Yeah. and get a round of applause every time they do. Oh, this king.
Yeah, look, he's wearing his goat hair shirt today to show how pious and holy he is. Which was a thing that would occasionally happen in the Middle Ages, because of course a goat hair shirt is extremely uncomfortable to wear. But you only wear it in public maybe one or 2 days, and then you can go back to, you know, your fancy silk. I think there's another aspect to this that you're forgetting that drives people to do this, and that's it's great for Instagram, because you can every day do another post about how you're overcoming your racism. And so it produces endless social media content for any influencer out there. it's as someone who produces content daily, I can say that if I was one of those people who was very concerned about their Instagram career and producing repeatable content, admitting some great fighting yourself is a great way to generate content.
And then something to work on. And I suppose that's also part of what's interesting about Mr. Steele is that, so this essay, like each one of these essays starts with a different story, right? And there's the connection between a story and a major idea. And the major idea here is the recomposition of the self. But the story is this personal confession. What really is, in a way, a beautiful thing, which in caricature and in general we're kind of maligning, this confession that he was racist, that he was judging this white woman as being a harasser when really she was just being kind because of the color of her skin. But does he make a meal out of it? No. I read this poignant section, but he moves on to unpack, you know, a very deep and broad analysis. And then this is just one essay of many, and they all have their own quality and their own thing. And this was written in 1989, and it's now 2021. And it's not like, I mean, his contributions between now and then haven't been sort of focused on this particular moment. It's not like he's made a career out of this thing. And I think that does feel different to that. Anyway, that just feels like an important difference, that somehow part of what perturbs me about the high schools in South Africa that advertise themselves as being racist, you know, please come here because we're racist, and that and the fact that we can admit that proves that we're really the best.
Right.
A line which, by the way, was taken by Princeton University, my alma mater, which is consistently ranked the best undergraduate university in America, in the English-speaking world. They said in 2020, we're racist. We found that we're systemically racist, so we have to take down the Woodrow Wilson's name from the buildings and so on and so forth. This podcast, we've talked often about what a terrible person Woodrow Wilson was in many respects. Anyway, you know, this is an advertising ploy that is for serious.
Yeah.
And exactly the way that you can tell when it's for serious in terms of advertising, but not for serious in terms of making things right, is when it seems impossible to find a proper endpoint.
Yes.
So for Shelby Steele, the endpoint is like the end of this little anecdote, which serves on the altar of example for a broader analysis of American geopolitics at the moment,
or right,
socioeconomic politics. And for Princeton and the high schools, it's like, what is the end point? There isn't really one in mind. It feels like someone, an advert has to continue forever because it doesn't have a phase built into itself. It's like a right, never ending thing that you have to just confess and confess and confess, and that's what's great.
I can't remember who, but someone made this comment on an American podcast I listened to. I think it was people from Commentary Magazine. Anyway, they made this point that wokeness is a bit like, as many people said, it's kind of like a religious movement. But what's interesting is it's like Christianity, but there's no salvation. You just confess sins forever and ever and ever. But there's also no punishment either. There's no sort of real hellfire or anything. It's just confession and rending of your cloth, you know, for over and over again, which is kind of weird because normally people aren't willing to sign on to something unless there's like some sort of obvious, what's the word I'm looking for? Release. And yet there's an interesting thing that I see all the time in kind of work circles and stuff is people will say, you see these, it's this whole idea in critical race theory. What's it? White convergence, interest conversion, conversion.
What's interest it? Convergence theory.
That's the thing. Yes. That white people will only be anti-racist so far as it helps them. And this theme is repeated all the time by kind of woke people. They'll say, you see, you just want to be called, you white people who say that you're racist, you just want to be called one of the good ones.
Mm.
So it's interesting to me that they spend so much time on this point, because it kind of seems like the sort of thing that should, you know, drive people away from your movement, right? And yet it doesn't. And yet it makes it even more seductive.
It still works. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think part of that might be, there is something about interest convergence theory that seems right to me. One way of putting it is like this, that enlightened selfishness and enlightened altruism
converge.
Yes.
And this is a long-standing thought.
Well, it's the magic of capitalism in a sense, isn't it?
Right. That's one expression of it. Look, there are others that touch more on the intangible goods, the esteem type goods, the sort of aesthetic goods in life. But it does turn out to be the case that you can at least make a very plausible argument that in the long run, and if I take into account, you know, children and grandchildren, my own children and grandchildren, or some group that I'm connected to that's going to survive my death, a long run that is longer than just my life, in the long run, it's not just better to be good in the moral sense, it's also greater to be good in the kind of selfish sense of like wanting greatness. So it's good and great to be good is a kind of thought. Our interest to converge. And, so capitalism, one thought, democracy is another thought, you know, the sort of more even distribution of power so that people have some shared status as citizens vis-a-vis the power machinations that coordinate violence in their environment. It's a funny idea if you compare the alternative being you're the king. Like, oh, doesn't it sound better that I'm the king? This sort of enlightenment argument is that no, in the long run, it really is better for you to be forced to be good in ways, it would be, you know, to share power in ways that mean your own whims and caprices don't dictate terms, which, and by definition, your wills and caprices dictating terms in the short run means you're getting your way. So the point of democracy is that you will really get your way in the long run if you don't always get your way in the short run, if you can lose in this civilized and rules-bound way.
Yes.
I think that's a right idea. I think convergence theory in that sense is tapping into one of the roots of the grand classically liberal tradition. What's strange about it is then turning the units of competition into races rather than individuals and thinking, right. You know, what really happens is that races only do things when their interests converge. Part of what's weird about that is it's not clear to me that races often do much. And when they do, it's only because races being empty in and of themselves. There's nothing to being white or being black other than just how you look. But so when races as a group do things, it's because there's a race nationalist project. And wherever there's been a race nationalist project, it's been a complete screw up. So that's one reason to think it's bad. Another reason to think it's bad is that if you look at the cases where you might think of a race doing something without a race nationalist project, for example, the abolition of slavery in the UK in the early 19th century, then it turns out that people, you know, because it's a government where everyone who can vote is white, and the slavery that they're abolishing is mostly touching on black people that are enslaved. But then when you look into the rhetoric, how people were actually talking, both in publicly and in private, in their diaries, in their letters to each other and so on, you find that doing this as white people is just not really a very common idea. They think of doing this as Christians or as Brits, and sometimes in kind of ugly ways. You know, let's prove that Christians are better than Muslims because Muslims have slaves. Let's prove that Brits are better than Americans have lots of slaves, and the Russians are full of serfs, and these are very backward ways of going about things. Our economy is much better, and we should end slavery. Sometimes in really compassionate and sincere and good ways. But whatever the ways were, I mean, in terms of whether you like them or not, what they weren't was explicitly racialist. It wasn't the case that people were saying, you know, whites ought to know better than abiding by slavery. That just wasn't an argument.
Right.
So even in that kind of case, you find that it's something that might superficially resemble a kind of racialist project. It's not a racialist project. So races don't do things together unless they're doing things badly, unless people are getting together according to race and then doing things badly. So it's hard to think of the entrance convergence thesis as lining up with that, because the entrance convergence thesis is precisely that things get better when these interests converge. And that's just not the kind of thing that you find across races.
It also creates a sort of problem of, okay, so if this is true, what does that actually mean for all of us?
It's not the kind of thing you find within races. Of course, it's the kind of thing you find across races because our interests converge across races. It's not the kind of thing. Sorry, carry on, Nick.
No, fair enough. It's sort of okay. So if white people can never atone and can never and are never altruistic at all, and this is a morally bad thing, right? Which is what interest convergence theory sort of claims. What's the point in ever having a conversation ever? What's the point in anti-racism activism? There isn't. Because, you know, people are damned by the color of their skin, which is which is one of the things that's so sick about this whole ideology, is that there really is no solution. It makes solution except the most hideous forms of race nationalism, like racial separation states, that kind of thing. Yeah. The answer. If you follow this stuff to the end of the road, it's not about, you know, fighting for equality like they sometimes mask themselves as fighting for. It's about racial segregation.
And we've already said Shelby Steele's very good because he talks about integration, the other side of segregation. And integration, just reading these texts from the late 80s, made me realize how weird it is that integration is so missing from the conversation today. It's just not – I feel like if one can get the Google Ngram sort of data analysis of words that appear in South African news articles and so on and so forth, integration is just not used very much in that sense. I do think that your point's exactly right. The premise of – the sort of woke project has it that people only work together across races, in particular white people only help out people who aren't white when it's in their narrow self-interest because they're damned morally from the beginning. That makes it seem that makes the whole project seem sort of self-contradictory. Like there can't be a project of actually spreading this awareness and this allegiance if that's one of your premises. But that, of course, doesn't matter if your project is not about doing something, but rather about performing something.
Right. And about deconstructing something. And this is one of the reasons I really despise a lot of this postmodernist stuff is because it's all about talking about problems and sort of deconstructing issues and just sort of sitting back and saying, society is rubbish. Capitalism is terrible. And then you say, okay, what's the solution? And then they say, well, our theory doesn't really give us any, so we're just going to go back to the Marxist well of the 60s.
Of the 1860s.
There you go.
Yeah, it is a funny thing. It's a funny thing. But, yeah, at least it's – yeah. I don't know. Another vain effort, Nick. I think I'm drawing a bow around what might just amount to being another vain effort to try to understand the position of people who sort of remain proud or ashamed of their phenotype. And I think it's a good project, and I think Shelby Steele is really good at pursuing that project. And
yeah.
My final thoughts on this are just that the most devastating thing about the text to me is that it's produced in 89, the year I was born, and it feels like it was written yesterday. If anything,
I feel like there was a gap in the middle there where it wasn't so...
Exactly.
But we've come back.
I myself adolesced in that gap. We both adolesced in that gap. But it's come back, and that does give the stark reminder, there's just something about that date, which is such a hard reminder that winning is not an everlasting thing, right? So you have the conversation, you convince someone racism is not the problem here. The problem is this and that, and we need to solve this and that. You've got a hole in your wall. Let's fix the hole. You've got a sort of plug that doesn't turn on. Let's get the power flowing. Yo, you can win that conversation and then lose it again the next day.
Our colleague Becky has this problem with sometimes when he argues with his friends and relatives about expropriation without compensation. They'll say something like, the problem is we, as in, and this we, they're speaking racially, black people don't own the land. And then he'll say, like, okay, well, here's some reasons why that's probably not the real cause for poverty and destitution in South Africa. And he'll go through a whole conversation, and he'll sort of swing them around, and then when they get to the end of the conversation, they've agreed with him on lots of points, they say, okay, you know, you make a lot of good points, but the problem you see, the thing that we're getting away from here is that it's the land that's the problem.
I agree with everything you said, this. But it's the land. Yeah.
Yeah, and... I think
we did an episode about that, about the
we did
the sort of these three-dimensional objects that are all inside of each other. You get out of the one Russian doll into the bigger one, and then the bigger one into the bigger one, and then you figure out you're in the smallest one.
Yeah, horrible paradox again.
Because you go, yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's a thing that I was reminded of in our group chat today, our work group chat on WhatsApp, where we often discuss many great and wonderful things. So just going back to this point of how there's sort of no solutions or anything in kind of work identity stuff, critical race theory, it reminds me, it feels to me very nihilistic in a sense, right? There's an element there of just, you know, you see where I'm going. It's not, I wouldn't call it pure nihilism. But there's
it definitely believes in things that don't exist.
Right.
Which is the opposite.
I do hear you. I was reminded of my favorite scene in the movie The Big Lebowski, where the crazed Vietnam War veteran, Walter, he's complaining about guys there had a run-in with some dodgy dudes.
In a bowling
And he refers to them, yeah, they're German guys with sort of who are menacing people. And he's talking to his friends, and he's like, these damn Nazis. And his friend, the Big Lebowski, says, no, man, they weren't Nazis. They were nihilists. He goes, nihilists? And then he sort of, there's like a moment of like, horror and revulsion in his stomach, and he kind of looks around and he goes, oh, say what you want about the tenets of National Socialism, at least it's an ethos.
it is a funny scene.
I kind of encapsulates how I feel about these kind of nihilistic ideologies. These sort of.
Yeah.
So,
right. So, I mean, I suppose one of the ideas there is that. Once you implement CRT, it becomes National Socialism. It becomes practical. You start getting the trains to run on time to do very terrible things. And that's...
I don't know about that. I don't think critical race theorists could get the trains to run on time.
Sure they could. I suppose they could in my usage of the... I don't see critical race theory. I really don't see critical race theory as being a particularly new thing. It just strikes me as a continuation of Dubois and National Socialism and Mussolini and what is going on in Japan. And it's all the core tenets are more or less the same, that you can tell who's right and who's wrong by how they look, that there's one kind of person that deserves the good stuff and another kind of person who deserves the punishment by how they look. And let's move forward on that basis. It's a simple and old idea. In that sense, I suppose there's some new language about it, but I do find myself often being the guy who pushes, and this is precisely not because I want to say that critical race theory is the same as the Nazis. This theory, it's the same theory underlying apartheid, which is a terrible thing, but distinct to the Nazis in terms of how terrible it was. Right. There's certainly a grayscale, different ways of, you know, tallest and shortest dwarfs of fascism. But also, there's a difference between theory and practice. So one can sort of espouse the theory largely in the esteem sphere, where I think it can be playful and even funny. You know, I can definitely imagine a play about a bunch of racists being very entertaining and informative. I can imagine a society, a dinner party, which gets kind of racy, which is maybe a bit irritating, but bearable. Whereas when it descends from conversation into power and property relations, it becomes unbearable. But that distinction between theory and practice is a real one. And I wouldn't want to hang any of the academics of Marxism for the sins of Stalin or Lenin. No, certainly would rather debate them and try and persuade them and so on and so forth. I feel the same about critical race theory. So in that sense, I suppose it seems nihilistic insofar as it seems so much like a call to action. And yet the best version of it is one which leads immediately into doing nothing, because that's the best you could possibly do under the assumption,
I guess,
in our environment today, that the way to judge people is by how they look.
Right. That's much cleverer than what I was going to say, which is basically then it has constant need to deconstruct. It has a sort of destructive nihilistic attitude towards the universe, in that it's this kind of postmodern thing of just being obsessed with there being nothing but cynicism behind every door.
Don't you feel like in this sense the progressives are the ultra-conservatives in the American way of looking at things? Like the ultimate progressives in South Africa are the EFF or Black First, Land First. And what they want is like a sort of 100-meter square garden for everyone to plant pumpkins and sing sort of ancient Zulu melodies. They're really conservative. They're probably
that's actually, it's funny you say that, because the way I view critical race theory, I do agree they share these tenets with you know, sort of horrid racial projects of the past. But I also see a lot of the way that it's done in practice rather than in theory as being very simply a reinstitution of a kind of the way that politics used to work around the world, which is corruption being the norm, payoffs being the norm.
Right.
It's special interest groups and political organizers getting their slice of the pie. It's patronage networks all the way down. And you can see that, for example, in the way that Hollywood deals with identity politics. People say Oscar's so white. There's not enough black people in films. Films are not telling black stories. They say these kind of things. Then what's the response? Well, consultants are hired. Lists are drawn up of how many black people have to be on every single project. And so what you get is this kind of padding of the whole system where you just put in these like
busy work,
these kind of busy work people to pay them off so that they don't cause political problems for you. And there's a whole industry to be made of, and that's also why so many people get attracted to it. It's because, you know, you can become a, what do they call them? A diversity consultant or something, and make a lot of money from telling people that they're racist.
So it's like once you, okay, so before you centralize violence, you have lots of different competing gangs, and it's as usual if you're running a business to have to pay bribes to this gang and that gang for protection money, and occasionally to have to get into a bloody war. Or battle, not war battle. Then you get the states going and you have interstate competition, but then the bomb, atomic bombs come along, so there's no international warfare between developed states. So that hard violent side is gone, and instead you have these power blocks competing for the vote and for sort of patronage money and that kind of thing. And if you're not careful, the same kind of mobster ethic takes over. But there was this interregnum where that was not the defining feature of politics in the UK or the US or South Africa, especially not yet. We had something very interesting going on. And it feels like part of what was lost was ordinary citizens sort of guarding their immediate environment, sort of seeing a fire next door and calling the fire brigade, as it were. Rather than just sitting quietly and watching their neighbor get called a racist when they're not.
Right.
And instead of calling the fire brigade, most people did just sit quietly and be like, well, someone else will call it out, or they'll put the fire out themselves or whatever. We don't have to rally. We don't have to say it's crazy to call the clerk a white supremacist because you know, he's fine. He won his Nobel Prize and whatever. This is just an example that comes to mind because I think most sort of white burden supremacist woke Easters really want to be de Klerk and sort of have a job and then get replaced by a black person who's even better. That's like the sort of ultimate esteem win. But they will never say anything nice about de Klerk.
But only after their pension is secured.
Yeah, but they'll never say a nice thing about their actual role model, which is another way of telling you can tell that your life is a screw up if you can't admit your role model is F.W. de Klerk. But you know, it's like people do live these strange. It's a strange game to play, and maybe maybe the problem you're identifying is the scariest point that we have screwed up, and that if we being just, you know, a sort of sum of a lot of banal moments across a lot of lives, that we didn't quite push for what we deserve, that the duties of citizenship were the rights of citizenship were taken for granted and the duties were not discharged.
I think that is a very big problem today, is that citizenship is not taken seriously.
We sat idly by, and so you see this regress, and it just strikes me as a cold, hard fact that if you let it slip for long enough, then it becomes the case that the only way to get things right again is by dealing with things getting much worse, by resorting to the kinds of ultimately by violence. You know, at some stage things do kind of lead to war, right? The worst case scenario,
right,
is violence. There are stages in between, though, in, you know, proper further ramifications.
Let me put it this way.
Implications of poverty, which is what we've seen. Like, sitting idly by has just led to millions of more people.
Things have to get bad enough to the point where people have to be active citizens again to protect themselves.
But it just doesn't seem good enough to me, because of this impression that I have that point only comes when we're violent. Like the non-racialist army. The non-racialist army of, you know, that just sounds, to me that sounds unacceptable. That is like, which is like not even an option. Like, let's plan so that that's not even an option. Let's act like that's not an option, because it's not an option. We can't wait for that to happen, because realistically, I don't even think it could happen. We need to win the debate. Yeah. We need to get our act together way before that point.
No, dude, because
by the time people are hacking it out, like, man.
I will say that my family and I, you know, being a lot of us having at some point worked for the DA or still working for the DA, we used to occasionally joke about forming what we would call DAPLA, the DA People's Liberation Army. Which, I'm not sure what it would look like.
Oh my word. No.
But I'm not confident that it would win. I think I even made a joke badge for Doppler before. I'll see if I can find it on my computer somewhere. Put it in the show notes or something. Anyway, we're going over time now, so we must call it to a close. Recommendations.
Well, let me just say about Doppler. I think that the non-racialist army is not unthinkable, because obviously a lot of political movements find it very enticing to think about the militant arm in theory or in practice. I think the non-racialist army is not unthinkable because our politics is less serious, but precisely because our politics takes life more seriously. And that, that can sound smug. Like, oh, well, good for us, so let's just chill out. No, dude, we gotta like enjoy ourselves and have a good time and like love life. Dude, we also really gotta get our act together. Okay, recommendations.
Do you have a recommend? Yeah.
I recommend that you recommend first.
As per usual. All right. I shall say that I don't know if I've recommended this before, but I recommend it again. Go on YouTube, search for a channel called Illinois Energy Prof. I think his most watched video is Chernobyl, the worst nuclear accident. And he's a really cool, restrained, chilled university professor who just talks basically using a whiteboard marker thing set up. And he just talks about various things to do with energy for the most part. And it's just really informative and really great to watch. He talks, you know, about, he's a big proponent of nuclear power, and he just talks about why, how it works, how you can make things safer, how you can avoid problems, why problems happened when they did, stuff like that. I find his videos enlightening and enjoyable, and I can highly recommend them to anyone else. That's Illinois Energy Prof on YouTube.
I like it. I like it. Okay, my recommendation is just what you'd guess it to be. Racism is not the problem. But I'm not just recommending that you go to the website. What I'm really recommending, here's my real recommendation. It's a claim. We claim that it's true at a root cause analysis level of South Africa's political economy.
You could disagree.
But figure out where it's true. Where do you know that to be true? One of the wonderful things about English, which I became more sensitive to after studying Russian, is the definitive article. Articles in general, but the definitive article in particular. The. Racism is not the problem.
Well, I think Latin or Polish has one either, actually, interestingly. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah, so some languages don't have it, and then you can sort of make some kinds of contextual claims harder to make, exactly like this one. This is a kind of claim that must be true in some context. So figure out that context. Is that claim true in your family? Is that claim true in your friendship circles? One or the other, or all of them, or none? Is that claim true on Antarctica, or at the bottom of the ocean, or in the stratosphere, or on Mars? Is that claim true at the UN? Is that claim true in Washington, D.C.? Is that claim true in Pretoria? Where is it true? Where is it not true? Is it true in your neighborhood? I think is it true in your church or your mosque or your synagogue? If it is true, identify that truth. Notice it. And if it's not true, hell's teeth. Notice that. Do something about that. If it is true, don't be ashamed to admit it. It's really not a bad thing. If racism is not the problem, it's true by definition that you've identified a good thing. And in a world of bad news, yeah, maybe if you just taken your time, think about a bit of good news. Maybe that's a bit of good news in the context of people's lives.
That's always good advice. Anyway, I think that's all the time we have for today. We're only over by 13 or 14 minutes. So I hope you enjoyed, and we'll see you hopefully next week. The plan is for next week. But anyway, keep the flag lovely flying. Krr, 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 krr.